Good morning. My name is Tim Jackson, and I have the privilege of working at the University of Waterloo. On behalf of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning to the second of Equinox Summit's daily plenary sessions. Today, we're going to be looking at some fascinating questions that directly impact education: what it's designed to achieve, how it's structured, and what's in it for students. This is all part of our goal to reimagine school for the 21st century. Before we begin, just a few brief announcements. The panel session will run for approximately 1 hour, followed by a question and answer period. I would ask if you have a mobile phone, if you would take a minute to just set it to silent or vibrate, as the event is being streamed live and is being broadcast for future broadcast. WGSI would like to acknowledge TVO, our presenting media partner, for their efforts in bringing these events to you both online and on television. And lastly, there is one more plenary session tomorrow morning. If you can't be here with us in the audience, please feel free to tune in at WGSI.org or TVO.org. And now let me introduce you to Dr. Michael Brooks, the summit's curator and the moderator of our plenary sessions throughout the week. Michael has a PhD in quantum physics, in addition to being an author, journalist, and broadcaster. As a consultant at New Scientist and a columnist for New Statesman, Michael keeps abreast of science news and the current events that affect political and cultural life. His best-selling books include 13 Things That Don't Make Sense and Free Radicals, The Secret Anarchy of Science. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Tim. So we're joined here every morning by the summit participants who have agreed to accompany me on this Learning 2030 journey. They are education innovators, thought leaders, and young people striving to create change in the world. And together, we're working to create a joint vision, which will later be published as an Equinox blueprint for a scalable, affordable, sustainable education pathway for the high school graduates of 2030. Let me introduce you to today's panelists. We have on my far right, Sunit Tooley, is the CEO of technology company DataWind, which aims to bring billions of people in developing countries onto the internet. DataWind is the creator of the Akash 2, the cheapest tablet computer in the world. In India, it is the number one tablet with 15.3% of the market share, and something known as the iPad has 11.7% of the market share in the last figures that I read. Sunit's vision is not so much for technology as for global literacy and education through technology. We're privileged to have him here. I understand he has roughly 4 gazillion orders to fulfill this afternoon for his Akash 2. Here we have Erin Miller in the center. Erin is a journalist and author. She says she's currently writing a book with the inspired title, The Flexible Brain, The Power of Learning a Little About a Lot in a World Ruled by Experts. This is a book I need to read, probably by lunchtime. Probably before this afternoon at least, when we're focusing on some very tough tasks. But Erin's focus is creativity, innovation, and education. And her recent series on education around the world, written for the Globe and Mail, is a tour de force of reportage and analysis on the state of global education. So we're very much looking forward to your input, Erin. Here next to me is Jennifer Carriero, who I would basically describe as a whirling dervish. She's someone who spent most of her life looking for ways to help young people set their own destiny. Her nonprofit organization, takingitglobal.org, is the most popular online community for young people interested in connecting across cultures and making a difference. The website involves over 400,000 members from over 200 countries. She has been a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. She's a social entrepreneur, an artist with a focus on how change happens, and has been pegged as one of Canada's future leaders. And if this is your first encounter with Jennifer, remember you saw her here first. Before we pick these extraordinary brains, we're going to watch a very short video as part of our Equinox series.
The 134 million children born this year face an exciting future. Some will create their own jobs. Some will create entire industries. Others will apply their critical thinking to solve problems humanity has wrestled with for decades and even centuries. Some will be artists or athletes. Some will lead their generation. Others will simply lead their families. Whatever these students decide to do with their lives, their education should be a help, not a hindrance. The question is, can the system we currently have deliver the education the graduates of 2030 actually need? At the moment, high school education is largely skewed toward funneling students into higher education. And as good as that may have seemed in the past, it may be too one-dimensional for the future. Though some traditional careers will remain, many will one day work in industries that don't yet exist. Predictions for future jobs include exotic positions such as memory augmentation surgeon, time broker, and weather modification enforcement officer. While we can't predict exactly what kind of job the graduate of 2030 can expect, we can begin to think about what kind of education will serve them best. Thought leaders suggest that the most important education will involve learning how to learn and how to adapt to suit a fast-changing workplace. Is there a way to release students from the factory model of education into a flexible learning environment that keeps them agile and creative? The urgent question is, how do we create a learning experience that equips them for the opportunities 2030 will bring?
So I've rather cheekily titled today's panel discussion, "You Can't Get There From Here." And that's the first question I want to kind of put to you all. Really, what is there? What is the purpose of school? So let me start with you, Sunit.
So in my mind, it's teaching people how to be part of society. And that is a very broad kind of statement that involves not only preparing them for an occupation, but making contribution to society. That involves teaching things like morality, teaching things like contributing to society. But if we think of that as a very broad kind of statement, I think the purpose of school should be teaching the youth to be members of society.
Right. Is that okay? I will come back to that, but let me go to Erin.
Sure. I think that the best way that we can sort of boil this down is to say that education is to help students, give them what they need to be able to fulfill their potential. And I realize that that's a frustratingly vague statement, and I'm sure that's what you were feeling as well when you said that, so I'd like to break it down a little bit. When we talk about potential, we often talk about the inherent abilities of a student, but what it's also is the possibilities that they have. Potential has completely changed in the last while because there are so many more opportunities. And what I like about having a fairly broad, frustratingly vague goal like that is that it's inherently flexible, and I think that it needs to be because we're not very good at predicting exactly where markets are going to go, what these jobs are going to look like. Because students will likely retire from a job that doesn't yet exist, we need to really keep that goal broad and think about the skills, whether it's global citizenship, morality, creativity, innovation, what types of goals can education, or what types of capacities can education be giving students that are adaptable? I think that's sort of the most important goal of education.
Okay, Jen.
Okay, I like the question, and the reason why I like it is because we don't necessarily ask it enough. And I see school as a space for learning about yourself, learning about your community and the context that you're living in, learning about the world, and I think that learners often don't get enough of an opportunity to define their learning objectives for themselves enough, because each of our paths are different and unique. So I think the space for school is that space for inquiry and of knowing and becoming who you are, and also finding what that path is that you want to pursue. So not the space for answers, but the space for questions.
Right, okay. Not one of you has mentioned grades. So, I mean, there would be plenty of people watching, plenty of people perhaps even in the audience who would say the purpose of school ultimately is to get the grades to be able to do the thing that you want to do. Is that not a fair assumption?
I don't think so. I think grades, I was thinking, my oldest starts university next year, and he's done well throughout school, and I was thinking as to when his grades mattered. And actually, in reality, his grades haven't mattered until grade 12. His grades have never mattered. I have a sister who is assistant professor in neurosurgery at Harvard, who had fantastic grades, but you wouldn't know it. It wouldn't, as long as you get into the program, it's almost irrelevant. At this stage in my life, who knows what my grades were? The fact that I got into engineering and that had a bar set that required certain amounts of grades was the only time in my life that I needed grades. But I think, information, comprehension, those kinds of things need to be separated from grades. Your ability to understand those concepts and apply those concepts is critical. And I don't know that grades always measure those things. And that's why I think that grades, to a great degree, are irrelevant to most of what we do in life.
I mean, grades obviously matter to some people. They might matter to parents who have come, let's say, if we're looking at people who want their son or daughter to achieve. So when a child comes home, they want to know what their grades are, or they might matter for how a school is funded. But the question is, who designed the system of assessment, and is that system still relevant? And also, is a teacher fully qualified in today's time to really assess, based on those methods of assessment, whether or not those are the right measures? Should we not be also assessing ourselves, also assessing our peers, assessing the value of how that learning experience was designed and delivered? So I would say that the current system of assessment is not relevant, but obviously grades do matter in terms of how schools get funded or how policies get made, but it's just a question of are we measuring the right things?
Right. Erin, you've written a lot on higher education, and there's a lot of talk that is kind of about the ideal system where we don't worry about grades, but the reality of coming out of K-12 or whatever is that you need good grades, don't you, to get, if you want to aim for higher education, for instance?
Yes, that's true, although there are a lot of new programs starting up. I think of the Open University in Britain as a model that I think we'll see more and more, where there basically is no acceptance requirements. They have, if you are willing to do the work, they will work with you to get a university degree. And I think as we see universities trying to reach out into the community and embrace this untapped talent of minds who were not educated in the traditional way, and when I say traditional way, I mean sort of in the Western tradition, I think we're going to see lots of opening up in that way. The danger of structuring education around grades and getting into university is that presumes that there's really only a single path to success, and that's just not the case anymore. And some of the talented students that are at the conference this week are really showing us that too, that are pursuing success in lots of different ways. And the problems that we have facing our society are so complex and pressing that we're going to need everybody, not just the students who get the grades to get into the top schools. So,
if I can also say, I was sitting in years ago when I was sitting in a classroom asking a question to the professor in my communication and organizations course. He responded to my question by saying, "Oh, don't worry, you don't need to know that." And I said, "Actually, I do need to know that, because the reason why I'm taking this course is because I'm here to learn about how to design an organization that has effective systems for communication." I had started a nonprofit at the time, and so my motivation for learning wasn't simply to get whatever mark that I was going to get on the exam. And that's one of the challenges when we're so grades-oriented, is that then it's dictated as to what we should or shouldn't know to be able to go deeper. It can discourage deeper learning.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure we're going to circle back to this. I just want to ask a couple of specific questions to you. Talking more globally, Sunit, I'm sure many of your customers have other things on their mind than getting into university, for instance. Do you think our education systems can be changed enough to provide the sort of necessary variety in the targets in terms of these varied paths?
I do believe that it can be changed. Unfortunately, throughout the world, primarily the the intended purpose of education or schooling seems to be preparation for an occupation. You know, it's a prerequisite for getting a job. People, when I look at rural India as an example, people perceive the value not for creating a complete human being who'd create value in society. They think the reason their kid is going to school is that maybe they can land a government job. That's the reason they think that they're sending their kids to school. And the moment they decide that that's not viable, then the kid is tilling the fields or working in somebody's home and things of that nature. And I think, in my opinion, one of the big reasons that you know, education hasn't changed the way that, that I wish it had over the last 20, 30 years is that industry's involvement in education has diminished over time. You know, if I think of what industry's involvement in education was 200 years ago, you know, if you came from a family of blacksmiths, then at a certain age, you know, your child started apprenticing in that area, and you decided that that's the way they would proceed. And what industry continues to complain about is that, you know, we're creating people in India. This is a very regular complaint, where the industry associations put out reports claiming as much as 70% of the graduates of engineering schools in India are unemployable. And you think, you know, all the hard work they've done, if 70% of them are unemployable, then there's a huge disconnect between what the industry believes they need or what the schools believe that they should be teaching. And I think it can be changed, but it requires a sort of a broader input from society. It requires a much more integrated kind of an approach. Because I come from a family where you know, my father and grandfather ran businesses. We got involved in family businesses, got exposed to family businesses very early on. I started taking my son and my daughters when they were 13, 14 years old to business meetings. I'd take them to conferences and they'd sit in the audience and they'd go to trade shows with me. Not necessarily with the intent that they'd follow what I was doing, but at least that they'd get exposure to more than what you know, the math or calculus that they were taking at school, and they'd get an understanding of society in a broader kind of way that's not really taught in school anymore.
Okay. Erin, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, if I can just add one thing to what Snu was saying. This is something that we hear about in Canada all the time as well, this idea that universities and high schools as well, of course, are graduating students who aren't prepared for the workforce. And I think that the issue often gets very confused. We talk about the job-ready graduate. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of politicians in Canada say about that is that, you know, they're coming out prepared for, you know, with these fluffy degrees that aren't giving them the defined skills, the tangible skills that they need to succeed, and there's a lot of talk about trying to get more students into the hard sciences, more students into engineering, that type of thing. But when you actually read, you know, talk to employers and read a lot of the surveys, both global and national, what you hear is that the things that employers are having a hard time recruiting are soft skills, their communication, their collaboration. They want people who can look at a lot of information and make judgments about the sources and be able to analyze that information. So all of those things, and they're harder to teach. But I agree that I think that there are lots of ways that education can get better at preparing people for that, and we're starting to see those innovations happen.
Okay. Jennifer, what do young people actually want from education? I mean, you interact with a lot of people coming out of school, just coming out of school, you know, going into new things. Well, do you get a sense that there's something they want from their education that maybe they're not getting?
I mean, it's hard for anyone to speak on behalf of all young people. We facilitated an online dialogue with hundreds of youth from over 50 countries to give input on student voices to an ISTE conference, an international conference. And a lot of people, young people, really talked about that environment for them to be able to grow, where they are inspired, where they have someone who believes in them. One of the things that they want to gain is that sense that someone is confident in them and helps them see what they're capable of that they might not have otherwise been able to see on their own. and that person may be a teacher or a guidance counselor or a principal or maybe a fellow student. But I think that's where a lot of value does come with, you know, people learning in a kind of collaborative environment, whether that be under the same building or in the same virtual right. network. That space that inspires creativity
right.
and knowing your capability.
So, Erin, you've been traveling around the world a lot, looking at different education systems. Do you get the impression that some places are doing it better than others?
Yes, I do. I don't think that there's any system that I would point to that's doing it all right by any means. I think that there's a little bit of hype around some of the systems, but I've certainly seen some specific examples of schools that I think are doing a really good job at trying to get at those intangible skills, that collaboration. One that I wanted to mention was I was in Denmark in the spring and visited Hellerup School, which is just a fascinating place. The first thing I noticed when this is a combined elementary secondary school, so there's students of all levels there. And the first thing I noticed when I entered was that there's no fence defining where the school starts. And I think that really captured what that school is all about. It has you walk in the buildings and there's no administrative office with, you know, walls around it where the principal is that sort of, you know, acts as the gatekeeper. It's just open space. There's like shoes everywhere, kindergarten shoes all over the place. And there's students running around doing stuff, playing foosball, working on computers, doing in this very open design space. There's no walls around the classrooms. And what happens, the only rooms that actually have walls are the music room, for obvious reasons, the computer lab, the chemical labs where they've got like different stuff in there, and then there's like, you know, one room for the principal, and that's it. And so what it creates is this really interesting atmosphere where students are constantly interacting with each other, and each class sort of has their own little corner of this building, and there's furniture that they can move around to create, you know, physical spaces. But there's a lot of peer learning that's encouraged by that model, where you have, you know, the grade 12 student who bumps into what the grade 3 student is doing and is able to help and explain things, and it's just inherently flexible. And that's what I thought was it really, really stuck with me as a potential model that we could bring into other schools in different ways.
Right. Did you get the sense that this is a happier place than school, maybe your own school that you went to?
Happier? I'm not sure. I mean, the one thing that I really notice is that engagement. You know, that came up a lot yesterday on the agenda as well. Students were... the lessons were really short. Like, there's a little sort of pod that the class sort of jams into for the lessons, where the teacher will introduce concepts, but then they're really encouraged to go and explore those concepts in whatever way that they want, through projects and through inquiry-based learning. And also in whatever space they want. So these students can go and find that quiet corner, or if they're the kind of student who works better in more of a cafe environment, they can find that. The library is in the middle of this whole bizarre structure, so you know, everyone's constantly going through the library where there's tons of resources. You're forced to walk through that space and we're all the time. And what I think it created was that students it's a nice balance of giving students control over their own learning while also making sure there's a lot of support and guidance and accountability, of course. But I definitely thought that the students seemed more engaged than what I remember some of my classes being like during high school.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I think that point of collaboration is really so essential. And when we look back to how schools are controlled, it's at the state level, ultimately. Like, if we look globally, there's not necessarily a global body that teaches people to live in a way that allows you to interact with other cultures. And we talk about benefiting society, and we have a lot of conflict that exists in the world. So if we look at the value of collaboration, it's not just an important skill for the workplace, but for the for humanity, basically, at large. And I think it's just really important to keep that in mind as we live in a more globalized society, to look at how school creates an environment that promotes values of global citizenship and collaboration, both for workplace effectiveness, for individual effectiveness, but also for our ability to manage in a very chaotic and turbulent environment.
And that requires a lot of buy-in from communities, from parents, from government, obviously. How do you get that? Sunit, do you have any ideas on that?
It's difficult, and I think of my own personal experiences and as we experimented with our kids in different kinds of school
as
environments.
We all do.
And I discovered for myself I didn't have the patience. To be honest, my youngest has many cousins within the same age group, and you end up comparing as to, well, they're reading at this level and yours is reading at this level, and I found that personally I didn't have the patience to allow him to get to that kind of stage, that open, more flexible, collaborative environment required. And despite that environment, I did the exact wrong thing that I promised I wouldn't do, and that is I got him a tutor after school to cover what I thought that he wasn't covering in school. So it was, I find that it is very, very difficult. Except most of the environments I work in, the problem is much larger. The problem is just getting teachers to school in a safe environment. Convincing parents that their daughters are not unsafe if they're sent to school. It's those kinds of challenges. To me, overcoming those challenges is a much bigger issue than optimizing the environment that my, kids actually go to school in. So it's difficult to convince. And even though I've been a big believer of a more flexible, open kind of collaborative environment, I found that when I experimented with my youngest child to that effect, that I didn't have the discipline myself to carry through with it.
It's not just me then.
Just on the question of, how do you create buy-in? And you're speaking from the perspective of a parent, and obviously we all carry many roles. One of the things Taking It Global ran in the last year was a conference for parents with Simcoe County School Board, and it was called Learning with Technology, Parents and Teachers Working Together. And a lot of the parents who came in, now this was more a reflection on technology itself, but a lot of parents had a lot of fear or didn't necessarily know how to engage their children using technology. This discussion created a lot of buy-in, and I think creating spaces for discussion, both with parents, but also another initiative we worked on, which is called Future Friendly Schools, is a global dialogue where we had thousands of stakeholders, including parents, teachers, students, principals, superintendents, school leaders, to actually offer their perspectives on what they see as the principles for a future-friendly school. And I think it's these types of collaborative dialogues that will create that buy-in.
Okay. And presumably the media will have a role to play as well, Erin.
I think for sure. I, before I get to that question, I was just going to, one more thing about this. I was writing an article earlier this year about the use of iPads in schools, and my editor kept asking me, can you find some parents who disagree with this, who are worried about their kid getting an iPad? And I had a really hard time doing that, which was interesting to me. And I was interviewing some people from the Northern Gateway School District, which is in Northern Alberta, who had brought in iPads for all of their kindergarten classes, asking them, were there any parents who were concerned about this? And they said, well, no, not at all. The only people that we had some resistance from were teachers, which I found really interesting. And I think, and I don't think that that's to say that teachers are resistant, but I think they are resistant to being pushed into innovation that they're not properly prepared for.
Right.
So training is a huge part of this, is an absolutely huge part of this.
So you can't just throw, you can't just throw an iPad into a classroom.
No, absolutely not.
Or even
not.
The iPads too.
I think that applies to any innovation. When we're dealing with children, people are resistant to changing what is working because the stakes are high. So in terms of getting buy-in, I think it's extremely important to make sure the support is there for the educators.
Right. So let me ask you, as you said your editor was pushing you towards a certain line when you were writing about this incident. I mean, is there a line that you sort of see that you sometimes need to push against in terms of reporting innovation in technology in education?
I think the line that I've been trying to push lately is trying to find evidence of how a lot of the innovation is impacting learning outcomes. There's a lot of excitement about some innovations, and particularly a lot that are related to technology right now. For instance, I've been writing a lot about massive open online courses, MOOCs, working on a big piece about that. And there's, you know, there's these claims that about how this is going to change the world, how it's absolutely going to democratize education and get, and I'm sure you hear about this all the time, Sunit, how we're going to finally get education to every corner of the world. But it's very difficult to actually analyze those statements and see and ask the hard questions about them. So that's what I'm really constantly asking people, like, show me the evidence. Let's talk about the evidence.
I can't resist asking you.
I don't just hear about it, I evangelize it. You're right. If you think of broad scale studies that show that there have been real results in those learning outcomes, I'm not sure that they're there yet. But again, I think you've got to look at students in different environments very differently. If I look at rural schools in India, where 18% of the schools on any given day have no teachers at all, in that environment, I think it makes a huge difference. In environments where if you are, you know, in Peshawar or certain parts of Afghanistan, where you are very, you feel very uncomfortable sending your daughter to school, not because you want her to have an education, but because you worry that you know, the acid's going to get thrown or they're going to get shot at or something of that sort, you know, without question. MOOCs and sort of flipped classroom type of models and so on are essential to get education to those levels. In this part of the world, again, coming back to my own kids, it's interesting to see how the, you know, there's experimentation going on around MOOCs even in high school. My son in grade 12, for his math class, they've decided to run it with a flipped classroom type of a model. And not exactly a MOOC, but specifically they've given them videos for all of the lectures ahead of time. And you know, for the student that, that wants to learn it, I think it's an essential tool. The, you know, the ability to, you know, I asked my son, so what do you think is the newest innovation in education? What are they teaching you? And he said, it's pause and rewind. and you know, that's you know, that's so powerful. You can't do it in a classroom.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when we went to school, I decided in one class to start taking a tape recorder in, and there were teachers that objected to us having tape recorders in classrooms. You know, it's so I think the world's changing from that perspective. The incremental difference between that and a good quality teacher that cares is very difficult to measure. You know, we went through school without pause and rewind. We went through school without the ability to record lectures, and we sort of turned out okay. You know, I think we're doing well in our lives. But you know, that's not the case with. Again, coming back to a place like India, where high school has a 68% dropout rate.
Right.
You know, the country has 220 million students. The number of kids that should be in school is 360 million. So you've got 140 million kids you've got to figure out how to deliver education to, and the 220 that are actually there.
Right.
Yeah, if I could just pick up on the point about professional development. Because there's the difference between what students might have access to on their own, basically at home with technology, or what teachers have access to and how they are given an opportunity to learn how to integrate technology into the classroom. We actually work on a partnership with the Toronto District School Board, and we run three professional development courses as part of our TIG Ed program: environmental stewardship, student voice, and global citizenship. And the TDSB actually gave release time for the teachers to be able to take part in this learning, and it's a blended course that involves both online and in person. And so the model of how professional development is actually delivered to teachers should also reflect the model that we're trying to ask our teachers to leverage and to embrace with students. And it's only in recent years that we've started to even think about technology as something to be integrated across disciplines and across subjects. And I think that that's what's also challenging for teachers and perhaps even overwhelming. There may be a lot that's out there, but when and how are they going to have the time to be able to identify common practice or good practice and what is going to be useful for them at that grade level in that particular time with their students?
Erin, is it happening? I mean, in your travels, have you seen that this professional development is in place?
I think that it's definitely improving, yeah. Just to respond to Sunit quickly as well, I certainly don't want to suggest that that MOOCs and that many of these innovations are not like very effective. I just think that we need to, when there's so many new, like as a journalist, I probably get pitched on one or two new education innovations or technologies or something every day. Somebody's trying to get me to cover something. So I think it's so important at this time when there's so many new things that are developing to be very pragmatic about and really ask hard questions about what is working. So that's very important. But in my travels, I mean, I definitely think that there is a lot of recognition that there's support for teachers. And also a lot of these innovations like MOOCs and our ability to be able to be taking that knowledge about best practices in teaching, they are also being delivered in new technologies and online and that kind of thing. So I think that technology is not just changing how students are learning, but also how teachers are learning so that we can share a lot easier what is working.
Okay. Let me just pull it back a moment. I want to ask you, or sort of get a little bit more personal about your own experiences and your own kind of thoughts on your history in education, and your sort of philosophical views as well. So, Jennifer, you once had a question printed on a Starbucks coffee cup, which read, "I wonder if young people were actively engaged in all aspects of society and thought of themselves as community leaders and problem solvers, role models, mentors, and key stakeholders, how would the world change?" And so what's your answer? Did you get any answers from Starbucks customers?
Yeah, I should clarify. I had that question before Starbucks asked me to print it on their cup, and I didn't get paid for it. But it was part of that way, the Way I Think series. My answer to that question, that is the question that drives me as a social entrepreneur, as someone who is trying to create those opportunities for young people to see themselves as agents of change. What I think the answer to it is that it would be the end of poverty, it would be the end of unemployment, it would be the end of crime. Even if I can't say the end, it would be a way to address some of the greatest social problems of our time. Because when people feel that they have a voice and that they have agency, then you're able to overcome a lot of other resorts that you might turn to. If you look at substance abuse or even just risky sexual behavior, for example. I mean, if you look at that stage of youth when you're transitioning into who you are going to be as an adult, it's a state of transition and it's a state of finding and defining your sense of identity. And so your affiliations, your peers, they're of high influence. So if you feel powerless, if you feel alone, if you feel isolated, if you feel overwhelmed, then you're in a state of desperation. And that's when you might turn to things that are essentially destructive to your health and the well-being of others. But if you feel a sense of empowerment and that your voice matters, then you're going to contribute in really wonderful ways.
And the kind of the normal academic education will come along as a side product.
I mean, education, but I shouldn't say it because our current system, I think we can all agree, needs to evolve. But in terms of your absorption of knowledge and learning will increase because your desire to learn, your mindset will be open and you'll be thriving because you'll be curious. I mean, learning is about curiosity. Learning is about the pursuit. It's not just what you know, but it's that pursuit and that motivation. Having a high level of motivation is very important to be able to be an adaptive learner and a lifelong learner. And so I would say that those levels of motivation would be very high.
Right. Okay. So you clearly had a high level of motivation. You're now a successful entrepreneur. And we hear a lot about, you know, we need to create more entrepreneurs. I mean, is that possible? Do you think anything happened in your education, your learning experience that took you along that path? Or was it something that was just always in you?
I think it's a mixture. And I think that, at least for me, it was just very early on seeing difficulties that my father went through in his business and learning to accept risk and failure as part of that process. I think what keeps people away from taking advantage of either opportunities or pursuing challenges is the risk and failures associated with those. And when we teach by the grades and what marks you receive, you know, we teach that this is the right way of doing it. Anything beyond that gets you the wrong marks. And I think that that needs to be part of education. You know, the whole collaborative approach of how you teach your child how to ride a bike. You did it wrong, you failed, next. That's not how you teach your child how to ride a bike. It's about giving them the confidence and accepting failure and continuing to try that over and over again. And I think that that's important in both education and in a personal kind of environment. I grew up in a town just outside of Edmonton, Alberta, called St. Albert, and I thought we had access to some fantastic world-class teachers. I really felt, I think that the kind of confidence and support that we received at that point has helped us carry through in many ways. And my brother has 78 U.S. patents on technologies he's developed. I get lucky enough to be invited in this kind of environment and talk to people way smarter than me about education. My sister is a professor at Harvard teaching neurosurgery.
Quite a low-achieving family, though.
I'm sure that this school we went to in St. Albert had a significant amount in the quality of teachers we had access to. And I'm not sure that that's the rule, though. But that's why that open kind of approach where we deal with failure in a different kind of way will help grow entrepreneurs and will help people wanting to be contributing members of society.
Okay. Erin, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would love to. I think that it's absolutely essential for education systems to find a better way to not just tolerate failure, but encourage failure. One of the trends I've been seeing at universities is that a lot of universities are creating an opportunity for students to take one class a year or one class. It's typically one class a year where it's ungraded. And the reason for that is to encourage students to take some risks and like push themselves out of their comfort zone. And like, they were always interested in physics, but they didn't do that good in math. So they're nervous about taking that physics class because it will impact their mark. And this is their chance to really like pursue that interesting thing. And that just, it seems insane that that's an exception, that that's like an added value. I would like to see an education system that is that is built from the ground up to encourage students to really push themselves intellectually rather than just be penalized for failure. And I think that's important to fostering entrepreneurship, but it's also important to fostering any type of creative person who is going to feel empowered to come up with new solutions. Finding a better way to deal with that is absolutely essential. I've been really interested in reading the work lately of the economist James Heckman, who found that he was studying what predicts later success in life, and he found that marks aren't as good of a predictor as different metrics around character, and ability to deal with failure is absolutely essential to that.
This whole state of entrepreneurial mindset is something we definitely need to focus on encouraging in the education system, whether or not people become for-profit entrepreneurs or social entrepreneurs or intrapreneurs within a large organization. We are living in a world that is constantly changing. And so I would say a resiliency skill is that entrepreneurial mindset. And it's both the ability to deal with whatever is called failure or just rejection. Like I can go back to when I was in high school and I spent the year putting together content for a high school newspaper. And for a variety of factors outside of my control, the principal called me into his office and he said, "I'm sorry to sour your lemons, but we're not going to be able to publish the newspaper." And I looked at him and I said, "Thank you for your feedback. I understand that the school is unable to support the newspaper for the reasons you've outlined. I'll be able to go out, I'll raise the funding for myself, and if I need to stand off school property to be able to deliver it and retitle it, then that's what I'll do." And it was one of those, I don't know where the courage came from for me to say that to the principal, and he looked at me and he said, "I'll go back to class." And then he called me back, and I did go back to class. And then, eventually he found the resources where it was a hybrid. I had to there was a bunch of things that I had to prove on my own, and he met me halfway. And so wherever that courage came from, it was an early moment where I learned is even less about failure, but more about how to respond to rejection and not see it as an end, but see it as a, okay, then we're going to move this way.
Right. And we've heard quite a number of times this week in our discussions and talks about the importance of some kind of project. I mean, clearly this was a project for you. Did you do projects at school that kind of pushed you?
I did. I've sort of encouraged my kids in the same kind of way. And, you know, I've sort of tried to address this question for myself as to, you know, why did I go in a certain direction, and why did my cousins go in other directions, and why did my classmates go in certain different kinds of directions? And I think having access to those tools early on, where 1979 we had an Apple Lisa or an Apple II computer that we were programming with and doing fun things with, outside of the school environment, I thought went a long way. Coming from a family environment where business and entrepreneurship was encouraged, you know, doing little things like running a newspaper route and then expanding it and getting employees to run your newspaper route while in junior high was part of that experience. So it was encouraged throughout. And I did the same thing with my oldest kids this summer. I encouraged them to think of a project and come make up a business plan. And they decided to buy a 3D printer. So they bought themselves a 3D printer, got half a dozen classmates to join them as part of a summer project, created a product using that 3D printer, and started marketing it, which was a very interesting experience, at least for me to see how they've gone this route, and how they've dealt with failures and rejections along the way, and you know, those kinds of things. So I certainly think that more than just straight classroom lectures, being able to do projects that interact with the rest of your local community. While in school, as early as a junior high kind of environment, I think is useful.
Jen, you get a lot of these sort of creative kids in school when they're younger, and not necessarily so much when they're older. I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of young kids. I know my 11-year-old started a business, a year ago, just making sort of folded origami ninja stars that, you know, his friends would buy off him so they could throw at each other. And it strikes me that something in the system seems to knock this out of them. Would you say we're natural entrepreneurs and something kind of just lets that tail off in the school system?
I believe we are all natural creative people. I mean, entrepreneurs is, there's a lot of definitions for what it means, but I would say as creative people, definitely we have it in us. And it's true that the more segmented also subjects are, the more segmented our thinking is, but we don't necessarily have a way to bring it all together. And that's why I'm a strong proponent of project-based learning and encouraging young people to develop projects, because we talk about also engagement of students, and not everyone is highly motivated. But the thing is, everyone cares about something. So you can take what it is that you care about or that you're frustrated about, or that just something that bothers you, and use that as a channel to develop a new solution. And doesn't have to be alone. It can be with your friends. And that's the other challenge, is the time frame. So, you know, it may need a whole year. And that's actually something I'm working with York to develop in the Faculty of Health, which is a new course called Agents of Change in a Global World. And it'll be a 6-credit full-year course where students will have to create a new project that solves an issue related to health.
Okay. Erin, is creativity, you know, which is sort of seen as one of these real buzzwords now, is that something to be nurtured or something to be taught?
I think it's a very difficult thing to teach directly in the traditional models that we teach. You can't really do a lecture on creativity that is going to have your students leave a little bit more creative. That doesn't work. So this discussion of project-based learning, I think, is extremely, extremely relevant here. And I also agree that finding, it doesn't necessarily need to be an entrepreneurial project, but finding that, freeing students to pursue that topic that really inspires them is absolutely key to trying to get at some of these intangibles like creativity. I reflect on my own education a little bit here. I have a very unconventional education for a journalist, which resulted in a lot of credential anxiety for me in the beginning of my career. People in my industry refer to J school, which means journalism school, and they say, oh, you know, did you go to J school? To which I always was like, oh yeah, yeah, I totally went to J school. When the truth of the matter was, I went to jazz school. I have a bachelor's degree in jazz performance on saxophone. And that used to be one of my regrets that, oh, you know, I thought I was going to be a musician, and then I went into school, and then I started writing, and I came out a writer, and oh, I wasted all that time. But when I look back at that, music was such a motivating thing for me in my life. And the things that I took out of my musical education were discipline and motivation and understanding how to be a motivated self-taught person, and to look back at history and see how important the greats were and how I can learn lessons from them and apply them. And I mean, I think that everyone would agree that those lessons are absolutely essential to being creative in any industry, whether that's a creative, you know, a more sort of arts-focused creative industry like writing, or as any other entrepreneurial endeavor. So
there's a danger, isn't there, that we talk about, you know, creating entrepreneurs as a means of creating money and helping the economy. But I know, Jennifer, you did you work as an artist, a part of, you know, your many varied projects that you do. I mean, is it good to encourage students who love painting to paint for the rest of their lives, even if it won't earn the money?
You know, I just attended a forum this past weekend organized by our former Governor General, Madame Jean, and it's called the Power of the Arts Forum. And clearly, artists are underpaid, and in a way, the profession is somewhat undervalued because of that. But artists contribute such an immense value. They help us to know ourselves. They help us to create a space for reflection. They actually contribute to, it has a power to heal people. There was a huge talk at the conference of the relationship between art and health and how it can be used to actually be a motivation for patients when they're recovering from trauma or injury or disease to actually heal themselves. So I think that we should definitely encourage people to pursue professions in the arts, and we should also ask ourselves whether or not we're valuing the profession enough as we actually should.
Otherwise, they'll all be living at home with their parents while they do these great jobs. I have a friend who's a music therapist, and he used to go into Great Ormond Street Hospital and work with the kids there. He used to come home with incredible, inspiring stories. And all of a sudden, the stories dried up. And I said, come on, tell me another. And it turned out that all the money had gone for him to be able to do this as part of the sort of cuts to funding. How do you convince the people with the money to pay for the arts and the creativity?
I mean, if I look at it from an arts perspective, I think it has to be connected with where the money is flowing, and to also look at how engagement with the arts is the basis, and to sort of use it as that justification for helping people, again, to know themselves, to know one another as a community, to relate with the world. If we look at, as a society as well, in a multicultural society, a multicultural world, we need to encourage creativity. And artistic expression is a channel for that. Also, if we're looking at integration of technology into the classroom as an example, well, technology for the sake of itself is meaningless. It's all about how it enables people, and arts and technology together can really lead to powerful storytelling. I mean, if you look at also writers, for example, I mean, there's so much power that an artist has, whatever that form of art is, to be able to bring people along a narrative and a journey. And so I think that rather than see arts as something so isolated, we need to look at it at the center of civic life.
Can I jump in on that as well? I think that there's a problematic assumption at the basis of that question, where how do we convince people to value the arts? Because I think actually now is a wonderful time to be an artist, a musician, a content creator, and that really what we should be asking is how can we help artists create their own industries and create their own money? There's lots of people who are starting to do that. I'm really interested in the School for Creative Startups in the UK, which is basically taking these artists who have always been in this, they've always been told like, oh, you know, you can be a broke artist, you know, pursue that, but it's never gonna make any money, and saying, well, actually, people are consuming more content than ever online. Let's help you figure out how to make this work in this new economy. And also here in Waterloo, we have the Stratford campus, which is, you know, it's very based in the arts, and they're finding ways of taking arts and helping give these artists and, you know, lots of other entrepreneurial type people as well, and engineers, and giving them the skills to be able to build in the digital economy. So I think I think that this idea that pursuing music or pursuing art is just the ticket to never moving out of your parents' basement is kind of an outdated idea, and I think that's very refreshing.
Okay. Sunit, let me ask you about motivations for entrepreneurship. Yours is very much towards education and moving, eradicating poverty effectively, isn't it? I mean, I get the sense that a lot of younger people coming up now through school, through the higher education system, are motivated by this sense of inequity. Have you come across this, that they want to do something to change the world rather than just to kind of get rich quick?
I think so, but I think that it's not necessarily separate from get rich quick. C.K. Prahlad wrote this book called The Gold is at the Bottom of the Pyramid. We are a for-profit organization, but the opportunity we're going after is 170 million kids in India don't go to school. There's billions of people in the world that can be positively impacted by technology. But you're right. There's a much broader global view today with younger kids, with the youth, than was necessarily when we were growing up. And that inequity that's there hits them harder than for us. I was born in India. I came to Canada at a young age. And my biggest complaint about India has always been the general apathy people have towards that divide. We see kids here, wanting to address those kinds of issues. And I think that it can be done even in a for-profit environment. If I decided to create a product or a solution that went up directly against the iPad or Samsung or whoever, I'm dealing with companies with $150 billion of cash sitting there not knowing what to do with that cash. It's a very different kind of competition. And we see the example of the flagship company of this local area having gone through some tough times exactly in that kind of competition. But I'm going after markets that the large players don't care anything about. That's not an area that they're focused on or believe that exists. So I think that not only for the purpose of social entrepreneurship, but as a for-profit entity, I think there's a lot of opportunity financially in that area.
So Jennifer, you work a lot with this generation of people. Are you confident with what you see coming through that we're going to see these inequities drop away, whether for profit or not?
I mean, young people, the young people that I work with are very passionate about the power inequities and imbalances. They are challenging not only themselves to think of what solutions they can bring forth, but they're also taking the stage to challenge policymakers or leaders of business, just to make sure that there's not too much greed, I guess you could say, in any sector. So whether they be leaders of a social enterprise that also could be for profit and for good, or people who are what I call megaphones, that are using their voice and the platform to influence their friends to try to create that change, but it's certainly a passion.
Okay, thank you. We're going to open up to questions from the audience now, starting with questions from our summit panel. There's a microphone over, I think, on the side here. If you could come and use that if you have questions for our panel, I'd encourage you to step up and do that. I heard from one of our very smart young people at our summit that asking about the purpose of education can be sometimes like asking about the meaning of life. It kind of evolves as you go through it. So perhaps you want to address some of these questions in your Q&A. Graham, please.
Hello, thank you for that very, very interesting and stimulating. A question initially for the gentleman at the end about the cheap computer and then a more broader one about MOOCs. I mean, it's great that you have a cheap computer, but I don't think it would really matter if they were given away free with cornflakes. It's about access. And so when we think about and also how it changes our education systems. And so we hear a lot, and not just an observation of the panel, but just generally in the digital sector, this sort of romanticism around MOOCs and what we call the democratizing power of the internet, which is, of course, entirely false. The internet is controlled by who has the biggest servers, as we've seen in recent revelations in the US and in Europe. I'd like to ask who we think MOOCs are actually for, because a lot of the people that we talk about, you know, the poor child in the rural village having access to MOOCs is nonsense. They don't have access. The speed of access. I mean, Khan Academy, wonderful if you have a high bandwidth internet connection and a device that can actually access it. That, I understand, isn't the case for the majority of the population. So I wonder if we could have a discussion around whether actually affordability of technology is a real driver and actually whether this romance around MOOCs is really hitting the people that we expect it to hit.
Thank you.
So I do believe that affordability is the real driver, and you can see it when you compare the number of internet users globally versus the number of cell phone users. When we launched this project in India, there were articles, op-ed pieces that people wrote and said, well, in a country that hasn't figured out how to deliver clean drinking water to its population and electricity to enough of its population. Isn't this a distraction from the core things that they should be focusing on? And my response has always been that anybody that thinks education is a distraction doesn't know what they're talking about. The solutions in these countries will be solved through education. And in an environment like India, where there's such a high percent of the population that is young, unless we figure out how to resolve the issues around education, nothing will happen. And I want to come to the issue of access. There are 900 million people in India that have cell phones. They figured out how to charge their phones, so the issue of electricity is not the barrier. They've got access to some sort of a mobile network. How efficiently you use that network to deliver content is another issue. We believe we've got a solution around it, and before the end of this year, we will launch a entry-level device in India in the $50 price point that will include free internet access, enough for the purposes of browsing, chatting, maybe not enough for MOOCs and video broadcasts. But to assume that will never happen is also naive. We already see in a number of countries, including India, broad deployment of higher bandwidth networks, and they will happen a lot faster than any of us think. Rwanda in the next 2 years will have an LTE network that's at least as powerful as the one being deployed in downtown Toronto with that much bandwidth available for its citizens. And I'm confident that they'll get that done. In India, we start to see...
is absolutely we agreed on access, because I think that the cost of device isn't an issue. But I think equally naive if we are to think that this LTE network is going to be affordable to the very people that we're talking about. I mean, the mobile data contracts, for example, throughout Africa are far higher in terms of monthly costs than they are in the richer parts of the world, ironically.
So you missed a little bit of what I said, and that was before the end of this year, we will launch a $50 device in the Indian environment with free access to internet.
For what kind of internet? A thin? I'm very curious about that. I'm not trying to be confrontational. I want to understand how that's actually going to work over what capacity.
Yeah.
I mean, you said it won't be high bandwidth. So is this a thin version of the internet?
It is your desktop version, but for basic browsing and chatting and so on. So maybe not free yet for video broadcasts, but that also is going to change. You look at the announcement that the Indian government's made very recently. There are two tenders they're coming up with. One is for 5.7 million units that are going to go to college university students, where they've set up free bandwidth, free Wi-Fi access in these college universities. The second are about 9 million units that are going to go into grade 10 and grade 12 students. And in those, they are obligating the national operator, a company called BSNL, to provide free bandwidth, 3G bandwidth, across to those users. So this is something, the kind of infrastructure for this is going to not only fall into place. To assume that one piece of the puzzle is missing, that the whole the whole solution is flawed, I think is a mistake. There are problems along the way that need to be resolved. Access is one of them, and we believe that there is significant effort being made around access. So not only will hardware become more affordable, but access will become as affordable, as ubiquitous as electricity is.
Okay, we could keep debating this, but I'm going to move on to the next question. Thank you.
Hello. My question could be for any of the panelists, and I'm going to bit a moose on the table. And that is that in our society, most of our educational organizations, our businesses, our institutions are rules-based. They are governed by a command and control model that is making it really difficult to innovate and to start doing the kinds of things the panelists have talked about, increasing creativity, increasing resilience, entrepreneurship in the classrooms or elsewhere. My own expertise is in the business sector, and I've seen research that suggests that on entry levels, businesses weed out the kind of creative, strategic thinkers that they later need in the executive levels. So once they have weeded out these types of people, and in favor of analytical types of people, they find their own executive suite is less robust because the talent is simply not there. So what do we do about this issue in that there's entrepreneurship, resilience is not present in the classrooms because our very institutions are mitigating against the kind of change, and powerful forces are preventing that from happening.
Erin, do you want to take that?
That's what this whole week is about. There's a lot of qualified people in this room to try to answer that. I totally agree with you that one of the biggest difficulties that I've seen as universities are trying to bring in this innovation is not a lack of will, it's not a lack of great ideas, it's the fact that our educational institutions are, by their nature, extremely conservative. Universities are, and they're conservative for a very good reason. We don't want to just be changing super fast when these are the institutions that are preparing our young people for the future and also passing on the values of our society. So, that's a huge challenge. I don't exactly have the answer. I was trying, as you were formulating your question, I was trying to think of some examples that I've seen where I think real change is happening, and a lot of them are opportunities where, for whatever reason, the people who are the innovators have been given an opportunity to build something from scratch. And I think that that's something that we really need to devote some thought to, is instead of just building something from scratch, how can we start to spur actual innovation within existing organizations? So it's not a satisfying answer, but definitely something I think we all need to think about.
Quickly.
The thing that went on my mind as you were asking the question was, how do we change the rules? And how do we collaborate in doing that? And it may take a decade, because it may take this generation of recent graduates who had the biggest disconnect to actually move into more positions of power. And the more that we have ministries of education and superintendents collaborating and listening to students, the more we can expedite.
Okay, thank you. Let's have our next question.
Hi, this is a question for Erin and Jennifer. We've been talking a lot about, not just at the beginning of this panel, but also during the last 2 days, about teaching our children and students the so-called soft skills, so such as creative thinking, analytical deep analysis, communication, collaboration, and that sort of thing. And traditionally, those kinds of teachings happen in the arts and humanities disciplines at the universities, for example. And yet, it seems to me that in the last little while, at least here in Canada, those disciplines are being devalued. So programs are being closed and that sort of thing. Then on the other side of the spectrum, we have the discussion about teaching children or closing the skills gap, right? So teaching more hands-on practical traits and skills like that, not just in colleges, but also in universities. So there seems to be an inherent contradiction there, and I would, politically speaking, and I would like to just hear your thoughts on this. Thank you.
I could start.
Go ahead, yeah.
I was just at a meeting as a side event to the Clinton Global Initiative, where we were advising Microsoft. They have an initiative called Youth Spark, specifically on the hard skills, the issue of computer science. And one of the recommendations that came up in our meeting of advisors was actually to make computer science specifically a cross-cutting theme, not just use of technology, but thinking like a computer scientist. And I would say it speaks to this larger idea of interdisciplinary thinking, because right now our academic institutions are in a way segregated. Like even in high school, I really enjoyed the arts and I enjoyed the scientists, and that just seemed like an anomaly. Not that many people are encouraged to leverage their minds in all of these different, the spectrum of ways, also kinesthetic, you know, with sports. And I would say that the more that we can encourage these interdisciplinary skills in our thinking and in our disciplines, the better decision makers and the better sort of prepared we'll be. So it's not to say get rid of specialization, but just increase interdisciplinary thinking.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that finding new ways to pursue interdisciplinary education is absolutely essential. And this is what I've been studying for the research for my book for about the last year and a half. And I think we are starting to see that in universities in particular. But when we start to compare the arts to the sciences, I mean, it's such a frustrating argument to have.
It's the road to hell, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately an arbitrary distinction that we've made. These disciplines and these fields were set up to solve the problems of the Industrial Revolution, but the problems that we're facing are inherently interdisciplinary. We don't need, we need scientists, but scientists are better scientists if they are also historians, if they also have that perspective. True. So, I mean, that's really the types of programs that I've been trying to find, and I'm finding them. Like, there are definitely some out there.
Okay, great, thank you. Let's have another question.
Question for everybody. If you were talking this morning to an audience of regular high school teachers, what one small practical thing would you ask them to change tomorrow that would be a significant step on the road towards your vision for education?
I'm going to hand that to you, Sunit.
I would put him in touch with my grade 12 son and help him explain to them the innovation of rewind and pause. You know, if kids had access to all of their lectures ahead of time at the start of the year and the ability to go back to those lectures versus, you know, the environment we were exposed to at times where teachers wouldn't allow you tape recorders in the class. I think that simple, very simple, easy kind of implementation can have a massive impact on the quality of education. My kids come to me with questions on homework that I have no clue on how to answer. You know, it used to be that I would read their book to try to understand it so I could help them answer it. These days, I type the question into YouTube. You know, wanting to learn how to balance chemical equations? Give me 5 minutes. Let me go to YouTube. So I think just this concept of rewind and pause, I think it can be very impactful in teaching.
Erin?
If there's one of the lessons that have come out of my studies of innovative interdisciplinary programs that I've been looking at is this idea of approaching quantitative reasoning like we do writing. In most programs, you're expected to write across the curriculum. It doesn't matter what class you're in, you are expected to be able to communicate and write an essay on whatever the topic. And I really think that we need to approach thinking about numbers in that way rather than segregating it into math class and then teaching kids from a young age that you're either a math student or you're not. It's very important in any industry, whether it's an arts-based field or not, to be able to think critically about numbers and use them and think about sources. And I think that the way that we've sort of segregated numbers into just math class ultimately disempowers people because they just sort of defer to the experts and are very passive about questioning and using quantitative reasoning to further what they're doing. So,
okay.
So if I'm a history teacher, what do you want me to do differently tomorrow?
I want you to, when you are reading material, when you're assigning material to your students, I want you to give them specific strategies for every time they encounter a number or some kind of quantitative argument to be able to think critically about that. And I think that, and to question it and to understand it rather than to sort of just passively read. Like that when we read a newspaper, for instance, there's so many times that I just read the news and I just sort of accept whatever the journalist has written as the number and I don't actually stop and think about it and think, okay, if there really was that many tons of I don't know, for instance, if that car actually did weigh that many tons, and imagine, what does that actually look like? Is that a reasonable number to use? I don't think that takes very extreme mathematical skills, but we're not teaching our students to think that way.
Let me give Jenna the chance for closing.
Make relevant connections. I remember in a class I had to create a budget for my life when I was 40, and that was something that really stood out to me at 14. Also, making connections to mentors, not expecting that if I, you know, to that history teacher as a student, I wouldn't expect you to know it all, but can you see me as an asset, see my curiosities and my strengths, whatever they may be displayed, and encourage me to check something else out, a resource, an opportunity, something I might apply for, a mentor I might be able to talk to, help make connections.
Thank you. I'm going to have to cut us off there. I'm sorry, that's all we've got time for. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd very much like it if you could join me in thanking Jennifer Carriero, Erin Miller, and Suneet Tooley for this fantastic conversation. Thanks also to our other summit participants who will now move into the day of collaborations as they sift through ideas for a school for the 21st century. And for those of you watching online, the next plenary is tomorrow at 8:30 a.m., where I'll be joined on stage by Greg Butler, Pauline Dixon, Jennifer Groff, and Adrian Lim. And we'll be talking about what we should be doing with the classroom of 2030, the real nuts and bolts of education. You can find details on that at wgsi.org and tvo.org.